You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it three times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Ugh. You said you were over him, but his hoodie is still in your rotation. It's time. Grab your phone, snap a few pics, and sell it on Depop. List it in minutes with no selling fees. And just like that, a guy 500 miles away just paid full price for your closure. And right on cue.
Hey, still got my hoodie?
Nope. But I've got tonight's dinner paid for. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. List now with no selling fees. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to How to Hunt Deer. Man, the first part of this conversation today, Jason, is going to be about turkey hunting, because I just got done with the youth season in here in Iowa. And I'll tell you what, man, it was a blast. I had an absolute blast, even though we did not pull the trigger on a tom. And so I'll tell you this, man, to start this whole thing off, last week, my son was nonstop. Dad, let's go, Dad. Come on, Dad, let's go. Let's go, Dad. Turkey hunting, man, got everything right, everything I need. Like, he was fired up to go. And so it was me, my daughter, my oldest son, and then my stepdad, who all went out. So my daughter shot her birds last year, And so this year my oldest son was the main focus. He went with me. We were the ones that went out and put ourselves in the best positions. They kind of flanked everything, held back. And, you know, without going into a whole bunch of crazy detail about the actual hunt, man, we got real close. We had gobblers just firing off a couple mornings, and you just see my boy's eyes. They're like the size of baseballs. He's just fired up. He's like, Dad, we got to go. Like, we got to move. And he wanted to be real aggressive with him. So we got kind of aggressive with these birds. And here's something that I wanted to share with you that I thought was extremely badass. So clear on the other side of this field, it was an afternoon hunt. It was about 6 o'clock, and we struck up a tom who was pretty responsive. And so I said, buddy, here, we got two options here. And I said, we can let him sit and we'll try to pick him up in the morning, or we can go after him right now. He looks me dead in the eye and he goes, Dad, no guts, no glory. And I'm like, let's go, buddy. Let's go. And so like we that. Stood up and we just went on a frozen rope right to that tom, started calling and responding. The bad part was, is he was on the opposite side of a creek that was the property line. And so we did not have permission to go over there. But long story short, dude, absolute blast. We got some fishing done. We caught, you know, some good fish. I probably caught the biggest crappie of my life this weekend. Oh. And so it was just a bunch of people who love the outdoors experiencing the outdoors, dude. It was so much fun.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's good. I always like that that first gobble that they hear for the year, you know, because I mean, even myself, you know, I still get pretty stoked when I hear a couple times, you know. But yeah, we did the same thing the last couple weekends. Take each individually, took my kids out, and they each had a day, but it wasn't productive. I mean, we both saw both sits we saw one time. You know, he hung up, probably 60 to 80 yards, you know, which is just too far for him. And but you know, my son, he's a little bit different with it. He doesn't have to sit there. My daughter sat there for 2.5 hours the one day. And I think my son made it almost an hour and a half, you know. So, but in Illinois, we can only hunt till 1 in the afternoon. So ours is a little bit different, you know. So we wouldn't have that nighttime experience. So that'd be kind of cool to be either have that option of roosting a bird or go after him right then and there. But that's cool, man. I'm glad you had fun.
I mean, we had a Tom on Saturday morning within shooting range. I struck him up and he sounded like he was at like 500 yards. So we took our time finding the best spot. You know, I thought he was going to come down the lane, and kind of flank in front of us and follow the lane. But turkeys aren't like deer in this sense where if you're calling at them, they will come in a straight line to you. They won't follow the contours of the land like a deer will. And so, I set up facing this lane. I kind of put some whole bunch of brush between us and where I thought he was going to come through and then get him walking right in front of us. But instead, he came straight towards us. So he came to our left side. And dude, every time I made a call, he gobbled, and he was gobbling at like 20 yards, and we could see him, but we had to try to make a move while he was behind trees. And so my son got up and started moving around and stuff. And I'm like, okay, bud, okay. Did you see him? And then he couldn't find the deer in the red dot, or the Tom in the red dot. Right. He could see him with his eyes, but then when he would go back to the red dot, he couldn't pick him up. And so then finally, when he picked him up, he was walking away, and he went past the range of the gun. And we played cat and mouse with that Tom, and he responded to every call for 1 hour with, and he was at within 40 yards for 1 hour of us. And it was intense, but we ended up not, you know, then I think we got too aggressive, and he spooked out of there. But overall, awesome time. You know, I got to spend time with my stepdad and my mom, and you know, we spent the night at grandma and grandpa's, and it was just another excellent opportunity to get outdoors, man. I love turkey hunting because you don't got to be quiet, really. You can talk, and it doesn't matter how you smell. It's, you know, it's just one of those things where if they're gobbling, you can go after them. If they're not, you just kind of sit back and wait for them to come to you. So I had a blast, man.
I've always thought turkey hunting was one of the best things to get a kid into, because
100%.
you can be a little bit more carefree with a lot of it. But it also it teaches them just a little bit of woodsmanship along the way. I mean, in and out of the woods, you know, we're doing the same things that we would do for deer hunting. You know, when we walk out, we're looking at deer sign just as much as we are turkey sign. And same thing with trail cameras. You know, my trail cameras, they're showing deer right now, but you know, I'm more focused on turkeys. And you know, from what I've seen in the last week, and you know, I explained to the kids, like, the flock's starting to break up, you know, and so now we have this shift of turkeys shifting around, and now we got turkeys in different spots that we didn't have 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And so teaching them the ins and outs of turkey hunting, I mean, I really think it correlates so well with the deer hunting.
So over the past handful of years, there has been a what I have perceived as a big decline in turkey populations. And I think everybody who I've talked to would agree with that. I don't know. What about you?
In spots, definitely. There's a couple spots that are really, I think, ramping up, but then there's other areas where it's kind of like the deer population, you know. And this will probably lead into what we're going to eventually talk about today, but I see pockets of, you know, 150 turkey, you know, at a time. And then same with the deer. I'll see 50 to 100 deer, you know, but then there's areas where there's nothing and they're desolate. And you know, I don't want to bash on this too much, you know, but because obviously, being in an ag state, you know, we love what the farmers do and everything. But man, I am getting like almost to the point where it's just disappointed in the amount of fence rows, the amount of trees, and everything that have to come down year in and year out for these farmers to, gain another little chunk of land or access a little bit easier. And I don't know how many times in my areas I'm losing deer populations or turkey populations because of stuff like that.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's the history of the Iowa pheasant population, is every single fence row or cedar thicket or whatever has been, I mean, to the point where they were removing buffer strips and like some of the farming practices. I feel like some of that's changing. I know that there are a lot of people who just farm the shit out of ground, and they're farming up to the fence lines and farming it right up to the timber edge, no buffer strips where all these pheasants and turkeys nest and things like that. So yeah, that's a big deal, but and that plays a part in, between the nest predators, between wet and cold springs, between some states have bird flus and stuff like that. The whole point of me bringing this up was that I have started to see a bit of an uptick in turkey activity the last 2 years specifically. I mean, there was a couple of years where I would hear one gobble a day. This year, man, who knows how many? Probably 15, 20 toms, within just hearing distance of me. So I was pretty excited that the population's coming back and we can get back to the older ways of hunting where you can be real aggressive and go chase them down.
So, one question I was thinking about is, so when you're deer hunting, and you electronically call in your deer, or do it on the computer, whatever. Does the state of Iowa ask questions like, how many wild pigs did you see? How many turkeys did you see? How many bobcat did you see? Do they ask questions like that?
No, I don't know. The last time I did one of those, I did not see anything. The usually in any survey, basically what you get is, what did you shoot? Was it how big were the spurs? How big were the antlers? Was it under or over a certain amount of inches? That kind of stuff. Sex ratio, what county, and that's about it. There's no, they don't really do a survey like, or at least not one that I've filled out anyway.
Yeah, because I know when we call in our deer harvest report, they ask these questions or whatever. When you harvested this animal, how many wild pigs did you see while hunting this location this season, and so on and so forth for turkey, bobcat, and you name it. And I just wonder, like, how much weight is put into that equation when they allocate for tags and stuff. So say in the fall, I'm hunting one location, and maybe I saw two turkeys, maybe I saw two bobcats, or what. So, how much does that play into? We have five spring turkey seasons here in Illinois, and there's three lottery applications for it, and then there's over the counter tags. And so, by the time we get to the over the counter tags, some of these counties have so many tags left, and some of these counties have zilch left. And I'm just trying to figure out, because some of the counties that I do hunt in, the ones that have no tags left seem to have some of the best turkey population. So is this part of that equation? Is it gray, or is it skewed because of me going out and I say, well, I only saw one turkey during the fall deer hunting season, but yet in the spring I'll see 150 turkey? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And a lot of it has to do with public land or private land too. So you have a guy who maybe he takes up 200 acres of ground, and there's maybe, let's just say, two turkey hunters on that ground. Well, there's those two turkey hunters on 200 acres. They're taking, let's say, even if they're successful 100% of the time, they're only taking off one tom every year. So they're going to see a very healthy, good population. If let's say the ground's managed for wildlife and deer and stuff like that, they're going to start seeing skewed numbers if that's their goal. Meanwhile, a guy a mile down the road who hunts public and it gets hammered is going to have a completely different view of what is there. So surveys would be really skewed, especially if you're on even on a private farm that lets a lot of people hunt. Right. And so it's so hard. I know they do in the state of Iowa for pheasants, they do drive arounds where they drive around and they do a count You know, they have a specific, and they do it like two or three times a year or something like that. And they see what, you know, what animals are there. But it's so hard because on tag allocations, we have the county that I live in. It is, doe tags are sold out immediately because it's a higher population county.
Sure.
Well, meanwhile, all of the deer that are being hunted are on private ground. And so a guy who wants to maybe go out and fill, let's just say a meat hunter who's less interested in antlers, he's going to be able to get two tags instantly. He's going to be able to get his deer tag or his doe tag and his statewide tag, which is kind of a buck tag, and then a firearm tag. And that's it. So he can only hunt three. Meanwhile, I can go down to my home county where I grew up, and I can essentially hunt does until the tags are gone, which could be 100 deer. Like if I wanted to go out and shoot 100 deer, I could probably go do it.
Right. Right. Well, kind of to the point, what I guess I was getting at too, is with these surveys and stuff that they do with that. Last week I was in and out of a couple jobs, and then I ended up back at home, and the entire time I watched the DNR in their helicopter go through at least 2.5 counties from east to west, and they would move over. They go east to west, move over. And so they obviously must have been counting deer numbers is what I was assuming.
Yeah. So. Or they were looking for like meth labs in the woods.
that's probably what it was. But
have you ever ran into some illegal stuff like that in the woods?
No. But I will say, so we had gone a long time ago. I had gone down to Myrtle Beach, and on the way we drove down. And on the way down, I got lost back in the Appalachians somewhere, and I got up into some really sketchy areas and
some banjo type areas.
Yep. I'm very confident that I ran into it that way, but no, not out in the deer woods. I haven't. So,
oh man, me and my uncles went, it was one of the first seasons I ever went turkey hunting. We ended up getting we ended up running into all these, like, it was like a gasoline canister, a propane tank, and then like a stand that this time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies, and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back. Literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code EMPIRE25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You can put like you can have fish fries on
a cooker
with the propane sits too, a whole bunch of empty buckets, and then a whole bunch of like empty wrappers of salt, like salt and empty packs of batteries. And so according to what I've learned over the years, that is how they, some of that might be some of the ingredients for meth. And so I'm just like, so my uncle ended up calling the DNR and they came and cleaned it up or whatever, but they had to go through this huge process of, you know, and making sure there was no booby traps, like and stuff. They're like, stay away from it because sometimes they'll booby trap it. So if you mess with it, it'll explode and then you'll get burnt or whatever. So, yeah.
No, I haven't ran into that. As far as a, like a weed garden, yes, I've ran into somebody's private, you know, stash of weed or something out back, you know, but no, not the meth. I'm sorry.
The things you'll run into out in the woods, man, I could do a whole episode on that. All right. It's that time of year, right? So obviously we're heavy into the turkey woods, but a lot of guys are out there finishing up some habitat projects. And today I want to talk specifically about food plots. Okay. I want to talk about, see, I don't do a lot of food plots, or I've done a couple throughout the years, but it wasn't successful. I don't have the property to do that on. And so I'm doing, I don't do food plots, right? I rely on natural browse, you know, acorns, excuse me. I rely on, you know, ag fields, that kind of stuff. You, however, you're as close to a food plot expert as we're going to get today. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. Like, let's start at the very, very beginning, right? How do you decide where and when and if you're going to put a food plot on a property somewhere? How's that start?
Well, so as soon as the season gets done, you know, you can kind of reflect back on where you saw, you know, deer movement and where neighbors were doing different crop rotations and stuff, and kind of deciding what the need for your property is. And so during the late winter months and then the early spring months, that's when you start with your, you know, you do your habitat improvements, you take some trees down, you clear some, you know, thick areas. And then once you decide that, you know, this is, you know, point A is going to be, or plot A is going to be up here, you got to get all that prepared for the upcoming months, because it goes quick. And, you know, as soon as we make that transition from winter to spring, and then you have that really wet period, and then you got spring now where you could get rain on and off, you got to have all your habitat stuff done before you even think to go to the food plots section of it. So then once I've decided that, then it's basically, what are my goals with my food plots? As far as, are there different foods that I want to try this year? Because, you know, we've gone different routes where we'll try different varieties of greens. We'll try different stands of, say, a sorghum plot versus like a corn plot. Or can we plant beans 2 years in a row in an area? And a lot of times we spend a lot of hours on prepping the ground and making it, you know, weed free and dumping money into that. And in all honesty, I mean, it's overkill. You know, we can spend so much money on chemicals or fertilizers or you name it. Soil testing is a huge thing at the end of the day, but this is a food plot. This is not, I'm not going to harvest this in the fall and take it to the elevator. So, I mean, to me, it's what kind of stand of corn do I really want? Does it have to be weed free? You know, does it have to grow to, you know, 10 foot tall? Or is this literally just for an access point? You know, if I decide to plant something tall like that, is this just an access way, or am I wanting them to eat this food too? So we kind of break it down, and we give them a couple different, like, I don't want to say destination plots, because none of ours are big enough to really make a destination plot. But basically, it's enough for them to either create like a little staging area plot, which I think, by the way, is probably one of my favorites to do, is create a little staging area plot in the interior of the woods, and then funnel off of that into another plot that holds them up before they actually get to their destination plot. And that's where I've seen the most success with it. Instead of, you know, if we had, say, 10 to 20 acres that we could plant in a food plot, that's great. But in that 10 to 20 acres, do you know exactly where those deer are coming out every single day? You know, I mean, because when deer head to a field, they might come out of the woods in a general direction, but it doesn't mean that that's their destination. So if you take on a map and you drew a big rectangle or a big square of this 20 10, 20 acre, 40 acre field out in front of your property. And then you backtrace it back into the woods to where if you have like a water source nearby, you know, you have nearby bedding, and you come off of that and you create that little teardrop or that little what do you staging area plot. And then, like I say, if you neck it down and make it come back open, as long as they can see in a direction to their destination, or that something that slows them up, you know, don't put walls in front of them. A lot of these things, that's just kind of how I establish where we're going to put them.
Are you trying to, when you think about locations for food plots, are you trying to pull deer off of a normal bed to feed pattern, let's say like away from a neighbor's property and to keep them on yours? Or are you trying to put a food plot in an area that already has natural deer movement?
Yeah, so a lot of these areas already have the deer movement. So I mean, they might just say the property, you know, they follow a fence line east to west, and they generally will do that from a neighboring property to the west, and they'll work their way to the east. And so all I try to do is put something that's going to catch their eye, or catch a doe's nose, or hey, here's some green. And a lot of times that's what those interior plots are, is they end up being like a green plot, because if you end up waiting and putting like a say planting in August or September and doing a fall plot and it stays green, you're going to keep those deer there most of the fall, because I mean there's always going to be something for them to choose from in there to eat on. But you know that their destination is not that. They will skim around the fringes of it, they will walk through the center of it, and they might not hang out in there, you know, for an hour on end or anything, but they might just come through for 10 minutes. But if that doe's hot, you know, now all of a sudden you get that buck, he's going to sniff in there, and then he's going to take his time to find that trail, and then he's going to, you know, meander on out. So depending on if you're hunting off of that staging area, or if you're hunting off of that, say that bottleneck out into your next, I don't want to say hold up plot, but there is like a buffer strip that I plant of corn or sorghum to hold them up, so they got to look a little bit harder before they get to their destination. It just buys you enough time that, you know, you can actually give them a little bit different source of food for one, because you're going to plant some greens, you're going to have some grain. And then also, I guess I should probably back up a little bit, but on edges of these, a lot of times there's oak trees or there's apple trees. And so you have some of that other mast that they can actually eat as well.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's unpack some of this stuff. Let's say you live in egg country, which you do. All right. You got beans and corn all over the place, right? Is it better, or what? Actually, not is it better. What kind of success have you seen planting corn and beans on your property versus a another option that is not readily available in the surrounding area, hoping that they choose that over what else is there?
So the one thing with planting, I don't want to say something quote unquote foreign, but in ag country, that's kind of what it becomes or is to start. So these foreign things, they basically take like about 3 years before deer get accustomed to, hey, there's peas over there, or hey, there's some chicory mixed in with, you know, some oats, or you know, just something different that you're not seeing year in and year out. You know, we have corn, we have beans, we have alfalfa. You know, I mean, those are three of the biggest ones that we have in the areas that I hunt. Very seldom do you see a field of peas, you know, but deer love them. But it takes them a while to get accustomed to, oh, hey, there's peas over here. They taste delicious, you know. They're not going to come to it necessarily and, you know, mow it down that first year. It might take 2 or 3 years before they're, okay, now I know what he's doing. So part of that too is what's your soil test show? Because when you plant some of these, you want to know what the breakdown value of it is. You know, so a lot of times we talk about crop rotation, whether there's corn or whether there's beans, and you know, you see farmers rotate year in and year out. Well, there's years where they'll plant beans and they'll plant beans again, and it's because the soil is lacking nutrients. And so the same with these green plots. These green plots, I mean, they're well, a lot of farmers plant cover crops. That's been a thing for several years now, where they'll have a field that needs extra nutrients. They don't want to necessarily spend the money on chemicals. They try to do more organic way. And so this green value is huge for your soil. So if a farmer, just say out in front of me, has a cornfield this year, and so next year I know it's going to be a bean field, the very first thing I think of that year is my access changes. Because a bean field is going to be shorter, my access is going to change. So now I'm going to have to change my strategy a little bit based on how the farmer plants his field. And so I'll probably put, you know, a strip, or when I say a strip, it's like 6 to 8 rows of corn in along that edge. So now I have an edge at least that I can access with. And then I'll plant off of that.
Okay. Is there a, so a lot of people, they don't necessarily want to become horticulturists, right? They don't want to necessarily, it's just like, oh my God, I got to learn science in order to plant a food plot.
No.
Like, because yes, you should probably do some type of soil tests in order, you know, to make sure your soil, maybe if you want to do it right. Cause I've heard horror stories about guys investing in a lot of seed. They plant, it doesn't work because the soil was shit and they needed something different. Maybe they needed to put nitrogen on the field or whatever, you know, whatever. Is there a fail safe where it's just like, God, I want food on my property. I don't know what to do. I don't want to put a ton of energy into like making the decision, but I will put the energy into getting something in the ground. Is there a fail-safe plant that deer just love?
Oh, absolutely. You know, so that I'm going to go back a little bit and I'm going to say just my personal experience. I've owned everything from a drill to a 2-row planter. And I'll be honest with you, most of the stuff I plant now is a little walk behind planter. You know, they're $130 on Amazon. You know, you could pick one up, or just a broadcast spreader. You could buy a handheld broadcast spreader with a bag, or you could buy a walk behind, and you could keep this as low budget as possible. I actually don't own either the drill or the planter anymore, because I found that the effective way for me to do this is to be able to paint it, flag it, and design it while I'm doing it, instead of having to try to bring in this equipment to do it. So the fail safe for me would actually be, I would probably just make sure that the vegetation, you know, as far as weeds and everything, that's at a very minimum, whether it's you spray it or you disc it. But then I honestly wouldn't be against doing like a 50-50 corn and beans and broadcast it, and then take a roller and just roll that into the soil, just so it got some soil contact, so it was buried to some depth. And this is as low budget as you can make it, but it's a fail safe because you know that deer love beans and corn, and you can mix them together, because as soon as beans and corn start coming up together, you have one that canopies and you have one that grows underneath, and you could pretty much eliminate some of the weeds with just doing that.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so I've looked at a couple studies. Well, I don't know if they're extremely scientific, but, you know, some of the people who plant a lot of food plots, talk a lot about seeds and things like that, say that it's the imperfect looking, right? So obviously the perfect looking food plots are going to get you a lot more tonnage per acre. Right. And so that's one thing. You know, like, hey guys, I want to feed these deer. I want to get these deer to have everything they need throughout, as long as as long as my tonnage per acre allows. And then you have other people who they just want the deer to show up so they can shoot them. And they seem to think that the weedy, ugly looking food plots that may not have the tonnage per acre as the beautiful looking ones seem to hold deer, and deer feel more comfortable in those food plots. Do you see that same results on the stuff that you do?
Well, I can honestly say it's a cheaper way. You know, when it's, you know, just kind of scattered about and there's weeds growing in it and stuff, obviously you're not spending the money on sprays, whether it's Roundup or whatever.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
Obviously, you didn't necessarily prep the site right, and you know you didn't have to have all the equipment. But it's not saying it's not going to work. You know, the deer, they obviously get used to the ag ground and how farmers plant it in methodical rows, and then that's there all year long. But if you give them something else that has a mixture of stuff in it, if I go back, I think it was like 2007 or 2008, I was just kind of starting to dabble a little bit with food plots, and I had a one acre piece to work with. And back then, and I'll throw the name out there because I thought it was a great product then, was Mossy Oak Biologic Biomax, I think is what it was called. And it was a mixture of the corn and beans and stuff. And it was a broadcast spread. You know, I had a little, gosh, I think it was like 36 inch tiller for behind a garden tractor. I tilled it all up. I prepared the ground. I broadcast it. And, you know, I was expecting this beautiful looking plot. You know, in reality, it was all scattered about. There was weeds everywhere, but it drew deer and turkey into that plot because it had everything that they needed. Now, fast forward to now, and now it's more like in the last couple years, I've kind of laxed back on it to where it's like, I'm not so worried about the weeds. I'm not so worried about, you know, this or that. It's more like being methodical in how I plan it. And if I went back 5 years, I was like, oh gosh, it's got to be weed free. These rows got to be straight. You know, I would almost darn near run a string line down it so my corn was straight because I couldn't stand watching it grow and be crooked. But now it's in reality, I just want to give them something to buy a little time while I'm in that stand. You know, they're going to come out of the woods, they're going to hit the staging area, then they're going to walk down another trail and they're going to hit another food source all on their way to a destination plot. Just buying me a little time to get my eyes on it, whether it's a doe or whether it's a, you know, a shooter buck that I'm after. Either way, just slowing that deer up in that process.
Yeah. So I've talked to a couple guys who are very serious throughout the shoot. I mean, like 10 years of podcasting that I've done. And there are guys who feel like there are some shortcuts to this food plot game and that they are doing somewhat of what you're doing, but they're letting other people spend the big money on destination food plots or using ag fields as the destination food plot. And so the only thing that they're doing is they're planting a lot of cover on their property, maybe not food driven, but with more cover comes more browse potential. But what they'll do is the guy that I'm referencing, who has told me the most about this is a guy named Tom Peplinski, and he does a lot of food plot management, and he's trying to get into the game, and he's told me like he just focuses on these very quarter acre, if not smaller, food plots that deer just pop out. Slow down, exactly what you're talking about. And he kills a majority of his deer in those types of environments. And then by the time they do get to the destination food plot, even if the deer are on another property, it's dark. Uh-huh. And so he just manages these little food plots that get deer to pop out or slide up, and the dude slays giants, right? And so cover and very small food plots is what he focuses on. But, you know, I'm sure there's, you know, just like anything, there's, you know, a million ways to skin a cat. And, you know, the big destination food plot could be great if you also have a lot of cover too.
Yeah, and there's something to be said with that. I mean, if you have the cover, that's great, you know, but it also with cover brings deer potentially bedding on your property. So you need to decide what you actually want. Do you want deer bedding on your property, or do you want them traversing through your property? I mean, because there's gray areas with that. You know, go back to this one chunk of property I hunt to the north of me. This guy has awesome food plots. He has, you know, 5-6 box blinds, you know, he hunts it, you know, he's managing his deer. And then I'm south of it. And so all I do is there's this opening on this saddle in the woods that comes down through this horseshoe with a little creek by it. So in this, on the top of the saddle, I've mowed it down year in and year out. And I go and I scratch it up with a rake. I pull all the debris off to the sides. I buy a throw and grow bag, and I scatter it right before rain. And what it is what it is. And there, I literally each year, there's enough in there that those deer that are coming through that bottleneck and that funnel on that saddle there, they're literally slowing up enough just to let me either take a shot or to bring them in while they're on their way to that destination. And it's right. It's maybe an eighth of an acre at most.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, it's funny how sometimes the least amount of effort can bring, it just comes down to work smarter, not harder. Right.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. That's why I said, I mean, I've had all the equipment to do all these things. I could have had beautiful food plots, you know, and I've kind of gone backwards with it to where it's like, I literally can carry most of the stuff in my truck toolbox.
Yeah. Yeah. If you were to choose between a grain and let's say like a clover or something like that, what would you pick?
I'd pick a grain personally.
A grain?
Yeah. And especially if you're, because clover takes a lot of work. I mean, you got to maintain it and you got to get it weed free if you want it to be successful and if you want it to last that potentially 5 years, you know, and there's a return on it. You know, if you can get it lush and beautiful. Because, I mean, deer love it, but it's also only going to last so long anyways.
Yeah. Okay. And so you're down for planting grains every year over managing a clover plot that you have to mow a couple times a year and maybe fertilize and things like that?
I personally am, just because of probably more so because of what surrounds my properties. And gotcha. And the fact that we plant a lot of fall food plots, which there is clovers and stuff in those, you know, they're an annual gotcha. Clover. So, and it's just easier to maintain. And I think there's more reward for the soil with the way we've kind of got this system going.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. What else do we need to know about food plots that, let's say someone's listening to this right now. And they're going, I want to plant a food plot now. What are some steps that we definitely do not want to skip before we start just throwing seed around?
Oh, well, I mean, the one property that we own, it used to be a timber, a solid patch of timber, but it's several, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago, they took all the trees out. Well, this soil is basically all clay. And it's timber soil. And it, for the longest time, we just kept dumping money into these food plots without doing a soil test. You know, so I think that's first and foremost. If you want a productive food plot, I think you can't skip that step. But just because you could go buy all the equipment, all the stuff, and you're just wasting money if you don't have that soil test and know where your pH is at. You know, and you could be doing more harm than good. You know, you could be throwing nitrogen on your food plots, but maybe you don't need it. You could be putting lime on it. Maybe you don't need it. You know, there's so many different things there. But I kind of want to kind of go off of it in a little bit different direction. And so this is also for the public land guy. You know, the public land that we have like here in Illinois, and I know in Iowa, food plots get planted and some of them get harvested. Some of them get, you know, the corn gets taken out and everything like that. Some of them get to stay, you know, stay through the season. And what I've noticed, like even scouting in Iowa or here in Illinois, there's a benefit to these food plots and figuring out that benefit of where they lie in accordance to maybe a actual destination plot on the outskirts on private ground could actually lead to a successful public land hunt. And you don't have to spend the money on that public land food plot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a win, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
At that time, it takes any type of decision out of your hand.
Right.
Right. And because you don't get to make that decision, somebody else is making that decision for you. And that at that point, it becomes more of a strategy standpoint of how do I hunt this destination food plot or this, you know, this food source, basically. I don't know if it's a destination or whatever the case is, because the state is not going, okay, here's where they're betting and here's where the food plot's going to be. And then we're going to manage all that. They don't do that. They're right. just saying, here's a flat strip of ground and we're going to plant in it for wildlife. And so that's how they don't do the strategy thing. That's for us to find out. So.
Right. Well, that's kind of the point too, you know, is like each year, you know, you look at these public land pieces and if you're paying attention on the outsides where the private land is, you might be able to pick up a crop rotation on the outsides of it. But then you also may be able to use the food plots on the inside of it that lead to those destinations. So I didn't want to leave out the public land hunters because, you know, there's a lot of them, a lot of us out there that do that. Let's utilize those resources too, you know. Going back to the food plots, if we're missing anything, the one thing that I want to overemphasize, the sky's the limit as far as the stuff goes, but it does not take that. I mean, it literally can, I mean, a few dollars can get you a bag of throw and grow, you know, a garden rake, maybe just a little walk behind spreader or even a handheld spreader will get you a lot. And you'll start seeing it too. But also don't forget that if you're planting something that's not necessarily, I don't want to say native or foreign, but if you're planting a new species in there, expect for it to take a little bit longer than just this fall.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel you. It seems just like most of what hunters do, especially in this era of, you know, digital content, there's always overthinking. There's always things that, you know, oh my God, I got to do this, or I'm overthinking this. What are some things that we just got to stop overthinking? Like stop thinking about it and just pull the trigger.
Sometimes I find myself debating on how much vegetation or trees or honeysuckle to actually remove in an area once I've decided this is where I want a food plot. And then I scratch my head like, is that tree worth taking down? Is that worth taking out? You know, because as much as we hear about these invasive species, whether it's honeysuckle or cedars or you name it, there is a value to it to some extent because that also allows deer, because deer basically, if you think about it, live at like a 5 or 6 foot level. And that's it. Anything above that, that's just an added bonus if it's not covering out the, you know, canopying out. So to me, I've kind of looked at certain spots where I will let honeysuckle grow. I will let cedars grow. And then I will get off of that just a little bit and I will create my travel amongst that. You know, maybe that's my buffer strip. Maybe that's my access point. But you can overthink it. And more times than not, I do. And then I don't get the work done that I wanted to get done.
Yeah, I feel you. I feel you. Outside of soil testing, okay, my guess is that the reason, especially if you're on a budget, the reason why soil tests are so important, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that that is going to allow you to know what food you can actually plant there. Because I believe you mentioned you threw a lot of money into some, you know, to try to put food plots into crap soil when certain plants need certain type of pH and other plants need the complete opposite of that. And so is there, does the soil test then tell you what you can or cannot plant?
Absolutely. And then the other thing that kind of dictates that too is your soil well drained, you know, because a lot of crops can't stand water, you know, but there are certain things that do okay. It's just making sure, because we have a couple pieces that where really the farmer needs to tile and then we need to tie into that tile and we need to drain it so we can get some of that water bog off of ours, you know. So yeah, it definitely does dictate what you can put in there. But that's where you got to take that soil test and you got to almost take it seriously in the fact that if I'm going to spend the money now, do Do I want just a 1 year reward by trying to throw money into this, or do I want to reap from this for 10 years? What's my goal here?
Yeah. Would it be advantageous to, instead of spending money on seed 1 year, let's say you're on a strict budget. Okay. You prep the food plot area, and then you throw whatever lime, nitrogen, whatever the fertilizer, even like, I don't know, go to a farm and scoop a whole bunch of shit into a bucket and then spread it out on this food plot or whatever the case is. That'd be the cheapest thing to do. To prep it for a year and then plant the following year.
Yeah, you could potentially do that. I don't think you're going to waste a ton of money if you were to invest it into like a cover crop, because it's still going to break down. Whatever comes up is still going to break down. The one thing that I would suggest, and I don't want to give too many tricks of it away, but become friends with some of these farmers. There's a lot of farmers that have plot bags left over from the year before, and they can't use them again this year. You know, these come in 10-pound bags or so on and so forth. It's the same with fertilizer. Become friends at your local co-op with these people, and they will give you a coffee can size of corn, and that will plant more than what you can probably even plant in a day physically. You know, sometimes it's jaw-dropping that, you know, we spend so much time thinking about buying a $450 bag of corn, you know, to plant an acre, when actually you could probably just plant last year's corn and it's still going to produce enough stalk height and corn that it's going to benefit your food plot too.
Yeah.
So if you want to do it on a budget, there's ways to do it on a budget. If you're looking at, you know, fertilizers and stuff, you can go to your, you know, box stores or whatever and just buy something that's 10, 10, 10, and it's just going to kind of boost the soil. That's it.
Okay. All right. So the soil's there now. Reducing weeds, reducing, whether it's getting rid of weeds, spraying grass, like once the soil is where you want it, is there anything else between the time you get the soil where you want it and the time you plant the seed that needs to be done?
Once the soil is where you want it, and just the timing of the rains. I mean, for me, once the soil is where I want it and I've got the ground pretty much prepped and I haven't planted it yet, it's basically having it soft enough to accept a seed, but then also, you know, is this something I need to cover? Do I need to drag it in? Do I need to roll it in? You know, think about that and then think about when your rain is coming. You know, if you work the ground up, say on a Sunday, and you know it's going to rain on Tuesday or Wednesday, you know that by Monday or Tuesday, you better have that seed in the ground, because you're going to want, you know, as soon as you can to get it in. Waiting for ground temperature, that's another thing. Ground temperature is a huge thing with planting corn and beans and such, because you don't want something to start to grow and then all of a sudden we get a hard freeze.
And then rot.
Yeah. And rot.
Yep. Okay. Once the seed is in the ground then, and, you know, If you're planting a seed and a seed can grow in a ground, that means other seeds can grow in the ground, and those seeds can sometimes be weeds. How much energy do you put into trying to get rid of those weeds, or do you just let it come up all natural?
For years, we have spent the time and money on spraying our corn and beans. You know, we'll let it come up and we will spray it to get it as weed free as we can. And generally, that's a one-time thing, and then we don't look back after that. And sometimes it works pretty good. Sometimes we end up with weeds, and we just kind of deal with it. But I'd be honest with you, a lot of the weeds, once they start to come up, if the food plot's not real big, I mean, does it hurt you to go out there for an hour and pull weeds? It might suck, but what do you want to reap from this? Do you want a reward? Or, you know, sometimes it's a little bit of physical back labor that could actually benefit you, and you're not spending the money on chemicals.
Yeah. Yep. And so you're okay with a little bit of a weedy food plot. That's great. If someone is very interested in the perfect food plot from a look standpoint, any advice there?
Yeah. I mean, invest in a good sprayer. I mean, and invest in either a good ATV, you know, and know, like if you're planting corn and beans, know that you can straddle the rows and everything so you're not trampling all over it. And if you have a compact tractor, sometimes they work pretty good as well. And you put the sprayer on the 3-point. A lot of that stuff's pretty good. And, you know, some of that stuff, yeah, you start to get into an expense. You know, a 3-point sprayer is not real cheap. You know, obviously having the tractor and stuff to use. You know, but if the sky's the limit, the sky's the limit, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just saying you don't have to go that route. We can go that route, but I don't see much more benefit to it on what we're doing each year in and year out.
Gotcha. And so that's more of a task for someone who's planting acres upon acres upon acres of food plots on big tracts of land.
Yeah, and so it's kind of funny that we're talking about this because yesterday my trail camera was going off, and I'm wondering, oh, deer, turkey, you know. No, I look, and it's my brother. He's driving by on his tractor, and he's going to mow down the corn, you know, because we still had standing corn, so we got to start prepping it and everything. So he must have mowed all the food plots down. I haven't talked to him yet or anything. I was going to text him, but, you know, so he'll babysit that because he lives fairly close to there. He'll mow those plots down, and then we'll spend a weekend over there prepping everything together. And then once we're ready, we'll try to schedule it so we can plant together and do all that. But then as the stuff starts to grow, I'll just see him periodically drive in there and he'll spray it. And then it's taken care of, you know. And since he's so close, I just make sure that I buy the chemicals for him and he mixes it and then he sprays it. You know, so we kind of work hand in hand with that. You know, if this year I buy the bag of beans, next year he does, and so on and so forth. It works good if you have somebody that you can work with this stuff too. That's another thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime you can divide and conquer both time and financially, that's a huge win on anything. So, it sounds though like the key factor here is time. How much time do you want to put into this, right? How much time do you want to spend spraying food plots or planting food plots or, you know, I mean, that goes for habitat work, that goes for the amount of time you want to spend hunting. You know, what is your goal? Is your goal to, you know, shoot a giant buck out of a perfectly manicured food plot? Or is your goal to simply hold deer longer on your property so that your kids can get a shot at anything, right? And so,
I think the biggest thing is you have to have, you know, the goal in mind. And that literally means, okay, I'm going to see more deer, or I'm going to see the deer I want to see. And then that other stuff becomes like part of the process. You know, I'm willing to work. I'm willing to put the time in. I'm willing to spend a little extra money here and maybe not go on that hunting trip this year or so on and so forth. They just kind of break it down from there, but it's all part of the process. So you got to enjoy the work to enjoy the reward.
Yeah. And that goes with anything, dude. That's a great statement there. And I think it's a good enough statement to where we can shut this episode down. I think what I want to do is maybe have a takeaway from this, especially for you. I want to leave this episode where it's at right now, but then I want you to think about food plots and anything that we might have missed so that next week, maybe there's a second part of this. Or maybe it ties into strategy, or it ties into time of year, or it ties into, you know, additional habitat type of conversation. And let's just grow off this particular episode. And I want you to do some brainstorming, and then we'll see if it goes anywhere next week as well. So, what do you think about that?
No, that's great because we're transitioning into that point where we're going to start putting our food plots in. We're close to that. So I'll be able to discuss like what we put in where and how we broke it down based on our strategy to hunt certain stands. So,
yeah. And I think I also want to involve weather, right? How far in the future, as far as forecasts, are you looking to know when to plant when to plant foods, like what temperatures scare you? Cause we're in a time of year where guys are probably itching, just like farmers are itching to get seed in the ground here pretty soon. But at the same time, we got it's hot one day, it's wet one day, it's dry one day, it's, you know, it's cold one day, to the point where we got potential snow in the forecast in the next, you know, handful of days. And so it can get crazy out there for knowing that. And I want to talk about that next week.
Sure.
All right. Jason, man, have a good one. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to the How to Hunt Deer podcast. If you could, we ranked third again this week in the deer hunting podcast realm, or whatever, however they calculate this. Yeah. I don't know. That's How to Hunt Deer ranked third. If you could do us a huge favor and go to iTunes or wherever you download your podcast, give us a 5-star review, and that would help bump us up. It would help us get more our brand and this content out there for whoever, like the gentleman we talked about last week, who was super excited that he found found this podcast and it helped him get a start into hunting. Outside of that, we appreciate everyone who's listening. Spread the word. Good luck out there if it's food plots or turkey or whatever you're doing this spring, and we will talk to you next week.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.